This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Michael Stube. Michael's the AVP of Managed Care Contracting for Orlando Health. Orlando Health is one of the most successful health systems in the country. They've done a great job on managed care contracting, on working with payers, working with direct employers. We're just going to talk a little bit about background advice on managed care contracting, on direct contracting with Michael today. Michael, before we get started, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Hi. Yeah, great. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate that intro. So I've been in managed care for pretty much 25 years. I've been with Orlando Health for the last four. And my background is I've worked on the hospital side, I've worked on the health plan side, I've worked in for-profit and not-for-profit. So I consider myself to have a pretty well-rounded background. And so that has created an opportunity for me at Orlando Health to really sort of explore a lot of areas of healthcare delivery and financing that I never got to in the past. And so it's a really exciting opportunity, and what we're doing at Orlando Health is certainly a great story to share with others.
Well, thank you. And let's start with a few pieces of advice you'd give people around managed care contracting. And you could float with that into the area of direct contracting as well, because I know you've done a lot of that as well. But start with a couple of pieces of advice you'd give people on big systems. How do you deal with your managed care contracting?
Sure. You know, we've taken on some very deliberate strategic approaches to, you know, the traditional managed care contracting. The first thing that we've done is really we take a holistic view of our payer relationships. And that's a function of the way the industry has evolved so much over the last several years. You know, many of the payers are now purchasing providers, and they own subsidiary technology businesses and other utilization management arms. And so that becomes a function of the totality of our relationship with them. So it's no longer just about the transactional unit of service for an inpatient admission. It's, you know, when we work with a company like United Healthcare, well, we're their clients for Optum as well for coding. So how does that factor into the relationship? And that's, you know, for us, a major part of how we view the managed care contracting, and that is that we are business partners that work in multiple channels now. And especially, you know, as the more they purchase physician practices, those become referral sources for us. And we become sources of clinical information that help them with their risk coding and their Medicare Advantage contracts. So it becomes a very symbiotic relationship when you factor in all the pieces. So that's really kind of the first thing that we've really done proactively here. The second thing we've done is we've gotten away from some of the traditional kind of, you know, sitting around a table and beating each other up over a couple of percentage points of increase every time we negotiate contracts. It's really more about strategic pricing and methodologies that make sense for both of us. It'd be much simpler in healthcare if everybody just operated on a percentage charge basis, but that's wrought with problems. And so we've moved into some very deliberate fixed pricing, but it has strategic value for both us as a provider, for them as a payer, and even going down to the level of the employers, being able to understand what they'll pay for a particular unit of service gives them cost certainty, and there's value in that. So we're very focused on how we articulate that value. And then the third thing is really just around building a good defense team, because you can negotiate the best contract in the world, but it's not worth the paper it's written on if the other party doesn't abide by it. And so you have to have a good structure built around enforcing the terms of the contract, making sure your contract yields are not being diluted by the denials and the underpayments on the back end. So, you know, again, those are really the core tenets of what we do that make our managed care team operate as effectively as it does.
And those are great pieces of advice and great thoughts, quite frankly. And I love the concept that we have to really look at the relationship as a holistic type of relationship, and ultimately long-term as hopefully a symbiotic relationship. And then I love your last point, that you got to play defense well, too, so you don't end up writing a great contract, but then losing lots of percentage points in the back end because of denials or not getting paid and so forth and so on. Another question for you. You've done a great deal of direct contracting, and talk about sort of how you view that. Is that a hedge against relationships with managed care companies, or is it just part of the landscape today? Give us a few pieces of advice on direct contracting.
Sure. Well, and first of all, I'll say, you know, it's a market-driven discussion because every market's going to have different dynamics. We happen to be in a market in Central Florida that has the largest single site employer in the country in Walt Disney World. And so we have a direct contract with them, as do our competitors across town. And that type of arrangement is what we sort of call a unicorn. It's a very unique relationship with a very large employer. It's not replicable, but it has catalyzed a lot of discussion in the market. And so we have done, you know, quite a bit of strategizing and activating those strategies around direct contracting. We've partnered with some of the traditional BUCA plans to kind of go after employers directly. And then we've also done some disruptive things. And so, you know, really that strategy has kind of the following tenets that we adhere to. The first one is tell your own story. So apart from the financial aspect of direct contracting, it's a direct relationship with the true purchaser of healthcare, particularly or obviously in a self-funded world, which a lot of the employer-sponsored healthcare coverage is. They're the ones that are the payers. The traditional BUCA plans are just processing the claims. And so we value the opportunity to sit in front of an employer and tell them our story, who we are, what we do, what makes us different. And so that's a central part of what we do, because we don't view this as short-term, you know, market share type of transactional work. It's building relationships for the long haul. And that only works when you're sitting down to people face-to-face and getting to know one another. The second piece of our strategy that really, really matters is it's not just the employers, it's their benefits consultants and the brokers. They often can be key allies and be the ones out front pitching the concept to an employer on your behalf. They can also be a barrier. And so getting to know the brokers, getting to know who is open-minded and willing to disrupt the status quo is central to our success, because you can spend all day long convincing an employer, and then if their broker comes along and says, no, you really don't want to do that, then you've really lost that whole opportunity. So finding willing partners in the brokerage community is a key piece of this. And then, you know, don't be afraid to challenge the status quo with the BUCA payers either. You know, I think part of what we've done here with this disruptive strategy, we'll keep them honest. Now, frankly, we've partnered with a couple of them on some high-performing or narrow network type of plan designs, and that will, you know, hopefully result in more aggregation of market share for us. But at the end of the day, it is a competitive landscape that needed a little bit of disruption because of all of the consolidation throughout the industry. So, you know, it gives us a little bit more control too over that competitive function. You know, we could bring in new payers, or we could try to become one our own, and I don't know that that's on the immediate horizon for Orlando Health, but certainly for now, we found willing partners that will challenge the BUCAs and challenge the brokerage community to look for a better way to do this.
And let me ask you a question. You said something interesting with the direct contracting. So many of us think if we're doing direct contracting, we don't really need the brokerage community. Why is it that the brokerage community is still so important there?
Well, I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons for it. I you know, I do think that there's an aspect to the sales cycle. You know, there's underwriting and reinsurance that has to be brought in. I mean, there are pieces. There's bringing together the pharmacy benefits. You know, it's selecting a third-party administrator. So there's a lot of pieces to this that go just beyond, you know, care delivery and a network of providers, which is obviously the piece that we feel we do very well. You know, we don't own a TPA and we certainly don't, you know, manage pharmacy benefits outside of a few small retail locations. So there are pieces that don't fall within our expertise. And I think there is a place for that community to at least broker that or bring that to the table for an employer.
Fascinating. And take a moment. You've been watching this market for 25 years in different ways. You're incredibly clear thinking about it. You understand it well. You're successful at it. Talk for a moment about what are some of the big trends you see between payers and providers? And partly you already touched on some of those anyways in your piece of advice on this. But what are some of the big trends you see with payer-provider relationships?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one of the big words in the managed care world, it's been around for a long time, and it you know, kind of cycles back through from time to time. You know, the last few years, there's been an uptake in this, and that is the term, you know, risk. So we grapple with this a lot. You know, a health system launching their own Medicare Advantage plan is going to be taking on a tremendous amount of risk, because you're talking about underwriting risk for an entire population of seniors. Risk, though, becomes part of our conversation in our contracting because there are capitation arrangements, there are gain share arrangements that can be upside only or can be bidirectional. And a lot of what we've done in our population health arena has done some downside risk contracting. And that type of thing is it's a leverage point for us in our relationships with payers that shows that we're at least willing to put some skin in the game. But we don't do risk just for risk's sake. You know, it has to be the right amount of risk for the right reasons and in the right populations. And so we've been very strategic about that. But I do think that risk is a tool that any health system could use to arm themselves with a little bit more leverage with the payers and maybe a little bit more, you know, motivation to succeed in winning more business in the market. I think another central thing to the – I'm sorry, Scott, yes.
Let me ask you a question on that risk. Because in the old days, providers often felt like risk was a name for discount, was discounts by a different name. Do you feel like that has changed a lot over the years? Like it used to be that payer was going to do withholds or put you at risk, and we all sort of knew it was just a different name for discounts. Has that evolved and changed, and is that bigger when you have big symbiotic relationships with the payers?
Yeah, it's a much higher level concept now. I mean, in a lot of these things that I've been talking about here, there are some unit price discounts in exchange for narrowing of networks. And that, you know, in it itself is a risky proposition because you're taking less per unit of service. And, you know, it's really a trade for hopefully, you know, more aggregate volume in whatever setting that is, you know, inpatient, outpatient, ambulatory. The risk component becomes an alignment of incentives. So when we have a total cost of care target, and if we hit that target, then we get some residual, you know, payments. We use that to fund a bonus pool for our doctors, and we scorecard our doctors on cost and quality metrics. And so that just becomes a self-perpetuating mechanism for continuous improvement. Likewise, if we didn't hit our metrics or if we had a downside risk and we owed money back, That's a pretty big stick to wield to drive behavior change and understand why we didn't hit those metrics. And so I think it becomes just a tool in your tool shed to continue to improve and get better at delivering high quality, cost effective care.
Thank you very much. I interrupted you and you were going to mention a couple other trends.
No, thanks. So, you know, one of the other things that really has evolved from our payer provider partnerships is this concept of data sharing. And some of what I'm speaking to here in risk and some of what I'm speaking to in direct contracting, it ultimately comes back down to, you know, who has the information and what are you doing with that information? And, you know, it's powerful. Now, we're excited to be moving into a conversion into an Epic environment here next year. We'll be having a six-month process to have the entire health system from inpatient all the way down to ambulatory be on one single platform. And the power of that information will enable us to do even bigger and better things with total cost of care contracts and with all these types of arrangements, but particularly in our relationships with payers, because we rely on them so much for the clinical data. And they may have to blind some of the cost factors so that they you know obscure what our competitors get paid for a unit of service. But for us, knowing when somebody's in another ED or knowing when somebody didn't fill their prescription is far more valuable when you have these total cost of care contracts, because you're able to identify subsets of your population and take action that will ultimately hopefully save money and yield better outcomes for the patient. And in the end, that's the value that we're pitching to employers and payers. The strength of our brand is in that performance. And then the last thing I'll just say is, you know, we've done some narrow network contracting, and we haven't seen a ton of success there yet. Some of that is, again, market driven. And then some of it, I think, is, you know, the macroeconomic factors. And we're watching very closely what happens with COVID and the fallout from the pandemic and to see, you know, how do employers react, how do payers react, because there may be some narrowing of networks that comes out of that as a cost containment mechanism. And as that happens, you know, we want to be well positioned with our solutions to deliver that value back to the purchasers, which, again, we believe are, for the most part, the employers.
It's fascinating what you say about narrow networks, because as much discussion over the years, and even centers of excellence contracts where some of the big, big clinics tried to do, or big health systems tried to do center of excellence contracts with the Walmarts, the world, and so on and so on, it's not really led to the amount of narrowing of networks that people sort of hoped it would, at least that were the big clinics that were doing these transactions, and maybe over some time, it will happen, but we'll see, right? I mean, the jury's still out on how far the neural networks go.
Right. No, I think, you know, again, there's another market-driven distinction. I do think we're a country that loves to have freedom of choice, and so, you know, if you're taking away people's choice, that's one thing. I think what could be an intermediate step, and this is where, you know, we really kind of support this strategy, is, you know, have an employer or a carrier offer, you know, a side-by-side slice offering where the employee has a choice of a broad network plan at one price and a narrow network plan at another price. And then you let the employee themselves, you know, vote with their wallets. And we suspect that over the course of a couple of years, you'll see more and more people migrate to the narrow network plan because of the cost savings that it generates to them in their paychecks. And then, of course, the employers will benefit from the lower cost for that plan overall.
Right, and we see some of that with different deductibles, different co-insurance and everything. We used to see it very significantly between the PPO option and the HMO option, where the difference in network led to a much different cost or lesser cost for the consumer, the employee, and so forth. And we do see some of it, but no, you're absolutely right, and it's a matter of how attractive can somebody make that choice with the limited network in terms of both price and providers, because so many of the complaints have been over the last 10 years that I'm aware of, a consumer employee looks at their choices and says, you know, I'd like to go to the less expensive plan, but it doesn't have the provider I really want in it. And so they end up sort of often bailing back to some sort of middle choice because of just the mix of the amount of choice they want to have, the right providers on it, and cost ends up with a fascinating balance. Michael, I want to thank you for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Superbly informative and amazing your depth of knowledge on the subject, which I guess shouldn't be surprising. You've been doing it for a long time, but really clear thinking and really helpful. I want to thank you for joining the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. What a pleasure to visit with you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Scott. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.